So what I'm going to talk about today is just a little bit about a paper that I wrote last year. I have a couple of talks about the cosmological constant, supersymmetry breaking, and so on. And then I'll talk a little bit about a paper that Roy Fischler and I have been writing over the last couple of months, which is almost ready here, almost is, about, in general, what observables are in cosmological spacetimes. So let me just outline the three points that I tried to make, and let me start by saying quite clearly that I consider all of these to be conjectures. There's a certain amount of circumstantial evidence, I would claim, for some of these conjectures, but certainly none of this has been proven. So the first one is that the cosmological constant, if it is really a constant, really will stay equal to whatever value it has and non-zero value forever, implies that effectively the universe that we see or will ever see can be described by a Hilbert space with only a finite number of dimensions, where the relation between that number n and lambda is given by a formula like this. K is calculated from the standard Bekenstein-Hawking formula. And this relation is to be thought of only as an asymptotic relation. And in fact, that'll be a theme I'll be coming back to again and again, that one of the most disturbing things about this proposal is that a lot of things that we think of doing in physics in a situation like this will really only be defined approximately, only as in an asymptotic expansion in large N. Now, some people were disturbed by this proposal. What I suggested in addition was that if you believe this formula, what it means is that the cosmological constant lambda is not a computable quantity. It's not, it's something you put in the boundary conditions of the theory. It defines the dimension of the Hilbert space your quantum system is working in. It's not something you can expect to calculate from a given Lagrangian, because a given Lagrangian always works in a particular Hilbert space, and that's a little disturbing. We always thought we were going to calculate the cosmological constant. What I consider the plus side of this...
We never thought that we had, within string theory, a theory of initial conditions. And isn't this just one more piece of that?
Yes, I would effectively say that that's the case. It's more generally, it's a boundary condition. I don't know if initial condition is the right word, but it's a boundary condition. And I agree with you about that, but I know that some people are disturbed. The thing that I find most attractive about this proposal is that perhaps giving up that fantasy about computing the cosmological constant, we gain an enormous amount compared to our traditional view of string theory. Namely, this one postulate by itself explains to us why all of the nice supersymmetric back-world string theory that we know are there are not realized in the real world. Because all of those states, the vacuum states with zero cosmological constant and exact supersymmetry, have an infinite number of degrees of freedom, an infinite number of states in the physical Hilbert space. If n is finite, they can't be realized. And in De Sitter space, there is no supersymmetry. So the second conjecture was that if I look for solutions of M theory, I always use that to describe this theory we haven't yet discovered, not just the 11-dimensional supergravity corner of it, but whatever the theory is that we will eventually decide that we have been working on all of these years. But if you insist on vacuum states with lambda equals zero, with some number of non-compact, asymptotically flat dimensions, four or more, then that leads to one of two possibilities. Either the theory is exactly supersymmetric, or the theory is not actually Lorentz invariant. It has some varying fields in such a way that Newton's constant at infinity, where infinity could mean either in space or at the infinite past or the infinite future in time, Newton's constant goes to zero and there's effectively no gravitational field infinitely far away in space-time, asymptotically in space, or infinitely in the future. And there are examples of both of those types of theories which exist fairly plausibly in string theory, where Newton's constant goes to zero. The O16 cross O16 heterotic string in 10 dimensions is one example. So one of those two possibilities I claim is what's going on in the theory. And the aside from 15 years or more of failure in trying to find a theory that had supersymmetry breaking and zero lambda, the reason that I really think that the principle that's going to force us to this conclusion in the end is, I think, an analog of an old theorem of David Kutesoff and Nadi Seiberg in perturbative string theory. In perturbative string theory, Kutesoff and Seiberg proved, using modular invariants, that because of the Hagedorn spectrum of the string, if you didn't have almost exact supersymmetry, then the theory was unstable. There was a tachyon. This, the difference between the number of bosonic and fermionic states at very, very high energies could grow, but very, very slowly, not anything like the Hagedorn density, not anything exponential of that type. Otherwise, you would have an instability. Now, in asymptotically flat spaces with four or more non-compact dimensions, there's a spectrum of black hole states whose spectral density as a function of mass or energy goes like this, where d is the space-time dimension. And this number is an exponential that's growing much faster than the Hagedorn density. It grows faster than an exponential of the energy. Most formulas you write down in quantum mechanics don't make sense when you have a spectrum of that type. All of the standard formulas for Heisenberg operators only make sense in the sense of distributions on a very, very radically cut off test function space. And I suspect, though I wish I knew how to prove, but I suspect that we'll find at the end of the day that in order to control that ultraviolet divergence, we're going to need, in the conventional way that SUSY controls ultraviolet divergences, we're going to need supersymmetry. Furthermore, in this case, you can very easily understand what the difference of the energy spectrum of fermionic and bosonic black holes is going to be if you break supersymmetry, because we know basically what a large black hole looks like, and we know how to make a bosonic black hole into a fermionic black hole. You take a gravitino and you drop it in. And when you have a spectrum like this, and you shift the mass by one gravitino mass, you get a difference in the bosonic and fermionic energy spectrums, which is still growing extremely rapidly. And so I think the analog of the Kutesov-Seiberg theorem is going to show us in the end that theories with lambda equals zero have to be exactly supersymmetric. Okay. Now it then follows, if you believe that statement, and if you believe that the theory we're talking about has anything to do with the real world, and notice that the arguments that I used here didn't use a hell of a lot of M theory or string theory. They just used the existence of black holes and the Hawking formula for the entropy. The reason M theory is important is that because of the work of Andy and Kimmelbacher and various other people, we now really understand that we should believe these formulas to really be counting states in the quantum mechanical Hilbert space of the theory, and we understand that entropy really should mean entropy in that old-fashioned sense. Yes, Steve?
So what amplitudes would this set of states contribute to that you're worried about in particular?
Well, for example, if you try to look at, two-point functions, lacking the expectations value.
Phase space, I'm not thinking so.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, there could be small form factors, for example.
Yeah, that's equivalent to saying that all of these operators in Fourier space don't probe what's going on above the Planck scale. That they're completely non-localized in time at the order of the Planck scale. It's the same thing as saying that I can make these operators good operators by smearing them with a smooth enough test function whose Fourier transform in energy space falls down fast enough. And so the basic problem is that if you don't do that, okay, effectively cut off the matrix elements of all the operators, then you will find that this divergence is there. Okay.
But how would supersymmetry help?
I'm not sure if I understood that. So
excuse me?
How would supersymmetry help?
Well, supersymmetry traditionally, I mean, I don't know the technical answer to your question because I don't know the analog of the technical machinery that Kutuzov and Seiberg used to prove this theorem was modular invariance of the one-loop string partition function on the torus. And I don't know what the analog of that might be, but that gives you a model for a situation in which there's a divergence that leads to a problem, and then the supersymmetric cancellations cure the problem. We also know lots of other theories where ultraviolet problems are cured by supersymmetry. I'm not pretending a lot here. I don't know how this is going to work precisely, but I think that this is the moral reason that this result has to be true.
If we really try to take Kutuzov-Seiberg seriously as an exact statement about the theory and not an artifact of ground states where there's a perturbative string description,
yes.
I mean, you get lots of other strong predictions, like that there can't really be a QCD string of conventional sort. Do you really want to, in this analogy, do you want to take Kutuzov-Seiberg as a real statement about all n-theory backgrounds, or just perturbative string limits that have nowhere strong coupling?
I'm certainly not thinking that Kutuzov-Seiberg, as it stands, is the right theorem.
Yeah.
Okay. I would believe that there's an analog of that whose details are yet to be worked out by someone younger than I.
What is the answer for the QCD string, or is what's the out?
I don't know.
I mean, there are outs that people suggest. I'm just wondering what you think the out is.
I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. And I don't really think it's relevant to this situation.
So you think this theorem will be an exact statement, not some analog of Kutuzov-Seiberg?
Exactly.
Expansion.
That's right.
But even this, I mean, this, I don't see why you argue. I mean, there are two things here. One is the test function. The other is how this behaves. And that does depend on the matrix elements.
Right. So you're saying, but effectively you're saying that all operators, okay, yeah, behave as if they were smeared with a test function. Okay, but no operators have matrix elements between the vacuum and very high energy states. Sorry?
With
exponentials that fall down at the appropriate rate to kill this exponential. That is as if saying that when you smear them with a test function, it doesn't make any difference. Okay. If you smear an operator with a test function whose behavior is exactly the same as the matrix elements of the operator, you haven't done anything.
Right, sure.
Okay. That's all I'm saying. Okay. Now, the third claim that I made, and this one follows, fortunately, because it's the one I consider the most unbelievable of the three, was that if you believe up to this point and you think the theory has something to do with the real world, then it must be that the correct formula, so this thing says that the gravitino mass would be exactly zero if lambda was equal to zero, and it's not clear exactly what gravitino mass means, as I'll be explaining to you in a little while, in de Sitter space, but it has some meaning asymptotically as the cosmological constant goes to zero, and this is a formula that could fit the data, okay? If David's discovery of, or the Brookhaven discovery of supersymmetry is correct, you could get masses of the right order of magnitude if the gravitational mass scaled like the fourth root of the cosmological constant. Now, in fact, in classical field theory, it scales like the square root of the cosmological constant. And in quantum field theory, with the Planck scale cutoff, it's even worse, it scales like lambda. Okay. So this is something that we don't understand at the level of quantum field theory. I suggested that the reason that we don't understand it is because of the breakdown of the connection between short distances and high energies that occurs when you go through the Planck scale in a theory of quantum gravity. Namely, when you go through the Planck scale in the theory of quantum gravity, you start to create black holes, high energy scattering processes no longer probe short distances because they start making larger and larger black holes. Again, there's certainly no strong evidence that this is true, and I've tried in various ways to find plausible derivations of a scaling result like this. And my experience has always been that you end up mired in things that you don't understand. In other words, you can get contributions that you can't from large virtual black hole contributions to mass formulae. You can get contributions that you can't argue go to zero, but I can't argue how precisely they behave either. So I haven't been able to derive this formula.
But have you been able to derive something else?
Sorry?
Well, what actually happens if you take the contributions you talked about?
Well, what you get is you beat two kinds of exponentials against each other. You beat the exponential growth of the black hole density of states with an exponential fall off of the probability of contribution of the of an intermediate black hole state to a virtual loop. Okay, the point is the following. If you have high energy lines in your diagram of high enough energy, I'm thinking Feynman diagrams, even though we're not doing field theory. You can, if you go above the Planck scale, you can get amplitudes, probabilities of order one to make a black hole. That's not a problem. The problem is that the very large mass black holes decay to lots of soft things with a very, very long lifetime. So the amplitude for tying all those lines together over a short enough period that it could be considered a virtual contribution to a particle mass, so it fits into the Compton wavelength of the particle, is very small and very hard. I haven't been able to estimate it. It's obviously sort of exponentially small, and I haven't been able to convince myself it goes one way or the other, or that this is really the right way to do the computation. Okay. So what I'd really like to talk about today, however, is not so much any of these statements by themselves, though I'm going to ask you to just believe in this first statement, if you please. I won't talk too much about supersymmetry. The one other thing that I do want to say about supersymmetry here, and this will come back and haunt us a little later on, is that if the speculation is correct, then in order to understand not just the universe, but to understand local particle physics, and talk about the world as we see it and predict experimental results, we really have to understand deeply what M-theory means in de Sitter space. Okay? And that, as you'll see, is very problematic.
Tom, did you have some heuristic understanding for why the normal calculations of the splittings might go like a different power of lambda in this way of talking, but other field theory calculations that we do fully self-consistently within field theory always work? Why aren't there large contributions from the same kind of large objects at high energy?
Most of the other things that we want to calculate in the real world have to do with parameters that exist in the supersymmetric Lagrangian. All right. So those parameters are protected those have a limit when lambda goes to zero. It's only things, if you're claiming that certain things go to zero as lambda goes to zero, it's the scaling of those things that might be anomalous and non-classical. If things go to constants, as most of the coupling constants in the standard model do, then they'll go to constants. Okay? They're there in the supersymmetric limit. So this is, I'm trying to calculate a very, what is...
But they could get small, correct? I mean, correct.
Well, surely they'll...
One quarter is not small.
Yeah, but the reason that the lambda to the one quarter correction is important is it's because it's the correction to zero. Okay?
But what is it?
It is small. It's that is a dimensionless number. It's that number over the Planck scale. Okay? If you look at corresponding corrections to the dimensionless coupling constants in the standard model, they're not that important.
So they're order 10 to the minus 30th corrections to everything. It's
10 to the minus, it's not as small as 10 to the minus 30th, but it's some, but it's a TeV of, well, I don't know what power it is, but, you know, sort of a TeV over M Planck corrections to lots of things.
So you form another proposite cosmological constant?
All of this only is propositive cosmological constant.
But it doesn't...
There's an immense discontinuity at lambda equals zero. Something very different happens. Lambda positive, the number of states is finite. Lambda negative, the number of states is infinite, but the growth at high energy of those states. So when I have an infinite number of states, in order to count them, I need to grade them by something such that each grade has a finite amount. And energy is the thing that does that. And the growth of states at high energy for lambda negative is like an exponential of the energy less than one. Because that's a conformal field theory prediction. Okay, so that's a very different thing than what happens at lambda equals zero. Lambda equals zero, something violently different happens to the high energy spectrum. Okay, now what I'd really like to tell you about today, though, is the way that I got into all of this. Why did I make all of these conjectures? And that's really based on something that I've been thinking about for a while, ever since what I consider the seminal paper of Fischler and Susskind, and then the wonderful generalization of it that Raphael Busso constructed, came out. And when I read those papers, I felt like my eyes were opening up and I was starting to see something that I'd been looking for quite some time. We've thought, many of us have thought for a long, long time, that string theory or M theory is holographic, that somehow the degrees of freedom are not local fields, that they live on these screens, and we've typically been thinking of this in terms of screens out at infinity on the boundary of space-time and asymptotically flat or asymptotically ADS space-times. And one of the big puzzles about such a description, a puzzle about which we, I would claim, have gained virtually no wisdom from all of the work that's been done on these models. I apologize to anybody in the audience who's actually done work on this subject, but I don't think we're very far along, is how is it that a theory like that could be consistent with what we normally think of as locality? Okay. And I believe that in this paper there's a clue. Okay. Namely, I think that the results of the Fischler, Susskind, and Busso work show us that at least for a universe that starts with a Big Bang, which just means there's a beginning, a finite time in the past, that these results show us how to derive in a holographic way the concept of particle horizon, which we normally derive in field theory from locality. So normally in field theory, if I have a Big Bang space-time, this is a Penrose diagram of various things in a Big Bang space-time, and this horizontal line is the Big Bang, it's the beginning. And then if I look at some backward light cone, I normally argue from locality that this region of space-time didn't interact with anything outside of this region of space-time. And therefore, there's a theory that describes just what's going on in here, just the local field algebra, if I was doing field theory, of fields concentrated in this space-time region. That's all I need. Those are the only measurements I need to discuss what's going on in such a space-time region, this region H1, which is backward like her. So now I want to outline for you how the arguments of Fischler, Susskind, and Busa lead you to the same conclusion. What those arguments and the precise form that's applicable to these kinds of regions is the more general form that was established in Raphael's paper. What those arguments say is that if I have a surface like this, which is a backward light cone in particular, there is a number associated with that surface which is a bound on the total possible entropy which anyone could ever measure inside of that space-time region that's bounded by this cone. It's really a bound on the amount of entropy that can flow out through the null boundaries of this region. And even for intersections between light cones, which this picture is misleading because it looks like it's in 1 plus 1 dimensions and it looks like the intersection of two light cones is a cone. It's not. You put two cones together and you get two pieces of a cone with a seam on top of them. It doesn't end in a point. There's a bound, because those surfaces are almost everywhere null, the boundaries of those regions, there's a bound for such a region as well. So now what that says is if I have a Big Bang space-time, there's a finite amount of entropy I can associate with that region. What does entropy mean in quantum mechanics? Entropy means the dimension of the operator algebra, or equivalently, when it's finite, the dimension of the Hilbert space in which the operator algebra acts. And furthermore, the bound is such, if you apply it to an expanding Robertson Walker universe, the bound is such that as I go back in time and look at earlier and earlier triangles, the entropy gets smaller and smaller. So what that's saying is that holography itself implies to us that small regions back near the beginning of the universe really only have finite operator algebras to measure. Now, what could that mean? I think that only makes sense if these operator algebras are independent of the things outside of them, namely that the Hilbert space associated with any such backward triangle is a tensor factor in the Hilbert space of the whole system, so that the operations that I do just on that part of the Hilbert space commute with everything else. Okay.
How many do you have continuous number?
I'll get to that.
If that's true that they're independent, then why can't you add them up the way that you usually do to get a much bigger, to get a Hilbert?
These are not independent, these are not independent spatial regions. These are independent light cones.
Yeah, okay. You could take a bunch of little ones that are independent.
That's right. And if you follow that, according to the rules of holography, you get a counting of degrees of freedom that obeys the holographic bound by construction. Okay. Because the dimension that I assign to any of these Hilbert spaces is always the number that's assigned to it by the Busa formula. Okay. So there's no contradiction between this and holography. It is not the same as saying that independent spatial regions at fixed time have independent operator algebras. It's not the same as the more general statement about quantum field theory that two space-like separated regions have independent operator algebras.
So you're saying it's obvious that if I add up the number from a bunch of little triangles that fit into a big one.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes. I can comment on it. The reason for this is that the number that you construct for each of the triangles is not constructed by looking at where they intersect your space-like slice, but by looking at the largest area on the triangle.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they will be on different space like slices for the big one and for the little one.
Right.
And it turns out that the area of the big one will be, I mean, sufficiently large to take care of the sum of the areas.
Okay. It always works that way. Okay. Now, yeah, I should have said this. Thank you, Raphael, for reminding me. The way you calculate this for these light cones is you go back and you look at areas that you can find by intersecting this light cone. And you then maximize the area that you find, and then that maximal area satisfies this condition of Raphael's about the deviation of geodesics of light sheets coming off of. Now, so this was the first thing that excited my interest here, that there was a possibility of starting to understand how locality, causal propagation, the fact that some little region of space-time didn't care about what was outside of it, which we usually think of as coming because there are little local degrees of freedom and they haven't had time to propagate out, that could be compatible with holography because holography actually implied a similar principle. Okay. Now, it is even, to my mind, more exciting than that. This is what the title of that slide says, because I think there's an argument that you can actually now start to encode all of the data about the geometry of space-time in information about quantum mechanical Hilbert spaces and their relationships. So I'm going to propose that we're going to do the following thing. The Fischer-Susskind-Busso bound is a bound, okay? I want, for certain subspaces in space-time, I want to make that bound into an equality. I want to assume that you can actually saturate that bound. Now, for reasons that I'll leave for Raphael to explain afterwards, it is plausible that this is true for these complete light cones, but not for the intersection regions, which have their light sheets kind of artificially truncated by the intersection point. However, what you can do for the intersection regions is you can find the largest complete light cone that fits inside of it and assign that region a Hilbert space whose dimension is given by the holographic area of that light cone. So now I want to propose that we could build geometry out of these kinds of constructions by thinking about the following thing. Pick a coordinate system in space-time, okay? Now, in that coordinate system, what I want you to do is make...
We have the space-time to begin with.
Yes.
You're building geometry, but you're starting with...
No. What I'm going to try to explain to you here is why the kind of data that I can encode into Hilbert spaces should be enough to determine a geometry. Then I'll propose that with some, as unfortunately as yet completely specified set of rules, that will replace the notion of geometry. So I'm going in steps. This is induction rather than deduction. So imagine you had a space-time and do the following thing. Pick a coordinate system and build on that coordinate system what I call a Planck lattice. Build a simplicial lattice where you start out at some point, you go one Planck unit in each of your three spatial coordinate directions and one in time, and you just fill up space with points like that. And to every such point, draw the light cone that goes from that point back to the beginning of the space-time, back to the Big Bang. And now take all of those light cones and all of their intersections and look at all of the numbers that represent the areas of all of those light cones and the biggest light cones that fit into all of their intersections. It seems to me very plausible that that's enough data to completely determine the geometry. Let me remind you that a Lorentzian manifold is completely specified when I give you its dimension, its causal structure, and the conformal factor. And although I'm not going, I don't yet understand an abstract way to talk about dimension. Yes.
What do you mean by that statement? That everything is
specified by.
Okay. If I give you a Lorentzian geometry and I tell you its causal structure, I tell you which points are space-like, time-like, and light-like with respect to each other, then that determines the, and I give you the dimension of the space-time, it determines the geometry up to an overall conformal factor. Okay. Now, the kind of information that I'm giving you here that can be encoded into Hilbert spaces.
By terms of the geometry, I mean, is that the same as?
Tells you what the metric is.
It's like
from the local shape of the light cone, you can determine where the S square is equal to zero, right? And it means that you can determine whole the S square up to an overall constant locally.
Right. So what I'm trying to say to you is that dimension, causal structure, conformal factor.
No, not that. Before that,
on every Planck point, draw the light cone back from that point to the Big Bang.
If you had 4 points, what would be your data?
I would have the light cones back from those 4 points plus all of the possible intersections between those light cones.
So four choose two, something like that?
Well, yeah, well, it would depend on whether they intersected or not. It depended which points you chose. Okay.
This is every point in space-time or on a space-time?
Every point in space-time. Okay.
Too much.
Yeah.
You could just pairwise intersections, or you wanted to?
No, multiple intersections as well.
This is just for globally hyperbolic spacetime?
Excuse me?
This is just for globally hyperbolic
spacetime? Let's see, do I remember the correct? Do you will allow me black holes? I would. Yes, you should allow black holes as well.
Yeah, no, but that's a condition.
Yeah.
There's something like that about
black. Not well, but like curve black.
And then take these light
holes.
Oh, instead of light holes, they're intersecting. Is
it
that? I wouldn't worry too much against the light intersections. Aspects of space times are probably unpredictable.
Yes.
We're all confused about the data. Could you do just some really simple example for us, like with 3 points?
Yeah. So if I give you 3 points, okay, right. There's a light cone back from point number one, and a light cone back from point number two. And let's suppose those two intersect. And then let's suppose that the light cone back from point number three doesn't intersect those. So I would give you, in that case, a Hilbert space whose dimension was determined by this, a Hilbert space whose dimension was determined by the maximal area here, another Hilbert space that was determined by the maximal area of light cones that fit into this intersection, another one that tells me about the maximal area here, and I haven't yet told you about some rules that tell you about how the intersections work.
Okay. So there would be four Hilbert spaces here.
There would be four Hilbert spaces.
And then you might add another point, say, down below P1 and P2.
I could add something here.
Yeah.
Okay. And so.
You'll tell us how the dimensions of the Hilbert spaces work.
But Hilbert spaces just mean even the integer number, which specifies the dimension.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yes. All Hilbert spaces look the same in the dark.
For
the dimension completely specifies what it is.
For any combination of the point, the dimension must.
Excuse me?
It's a vector space with the inner product. There's no inner product, or?
There is an inner product. It's quantum mechanics.
So for
it's quantum
any
mechanics.
Of points, the dimension of the Hilbert space of the intersection must be integer, right? And at the same moment, you say that the intersections must be tensor vectors. It means that the dimension is a divisor.
It has to be a divisor, yes. It's a lot of very complicated information about the Hilbert spaces. So let me tell you how I want Hilbert spaces like this to be related to each other. So let's talk about two of these basic light cones and think about the intersection between the two of them, okay? What the relationship that I will claim exists is just what I said before. The Hilbert space that's associated with this region here, which is associated with some light cone that completely fits into here. That must be complete of itself. It must fit in as a tensor factor to the rest of the Hilbert spaces. It must be that physics inside that light cone can be described just by measurements inside that light cone. Okay, that I claim is what it means to say that there's a bound on the entropy of that system. And so this says that H1 is equal to a Hilbert space H12 tensor some other thing, call it D12, and H2 is H21 tensor D21, where the D's don't matter for this terribly much. What's important is that there's a unitary map which maps H21 into H12, okay? And that's an isomorphism. They have the same dimension, and it's embedded as a tensor factor in each one. Okay. Then when, yes?
The dimension of H21 is the largest area of the largest light cone that fits just
that in fits inside of O12.
So there will be points in O12 that are not inside that light cone.
That's correct.
Why don't we have to worry about missing that information?
Well, because that... Okay, first of all, I think that if the spacings are small enough, that you're probably talking about things that don't matter. Mm-hmm. Okay? I mean, if I tell you Planck distances, then it probably doesn't matter very much. But, a very important point about this is at the end of the day, what I want you to do is abstract the Hilbert spaces away from the geometry. Okay, and just talk about the Hilbert spaces. The geometry is only going to make sense in some limiting regime. Okay, and then I think the coverage is going, if the axioms are such that you really get a net of Hilbert spaces associated with this Planck lattice, then these differences just aren't going to matter.
Can you go the other way? So you've shown how to associate some structure like this to a space-time. Can you actually, given a set of Hilbert spaces and a set of decompositions and tensor okay. products, you need to construct a space-time? Or is it not unique?
That's conjecture number four, okay? But, it's less than a conjecture because I know for a fact that I don't yet know all the relevant axioms. Okay.
This is defined, this way is only defined for discretizations of space-time anyway. Must depend on how you suppression.
Right.
Complex as
well. Well, I would suggest to you that the geometry of space-time at distance is less than the Planck scale doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, maybe it doesn't, but okay. I'm saying this construction
yes.
has got to depend a lot on how you slice things up.
Oh, definitely depends on how you slice things up. That's the analog of general coordinate invariance, and even more than that. In a holographic theory, there's a larger gauge invariance which has to do with the question of how you choose holographic screens. Okay? And what I've done here is I've sort of taken a coordinate system and given a rigid prescription, given that coordinate system, though it's not completely rigid because I could have taken a different set of Planck space points in the same coordinates. Okay? So there are two kinds of gauge freedom here. And one of the things that I don't know how to tell you is what once you I give you a collection of Hilbert spaces, what are those equivalence relations? How do you tell the two collections of Hilbert spaces obey the right rules to be the same space-time? Okay.
If the universe ends up in a big crunch, you just can choose one.
If the universe ends up in a big crunch, I'm extremely confused about what to say. I will talk here only about space-times that, in a classical sense, expand indefinitely.
But it suggests that you can just use one Hilbert space of finite dimension with no other data.
Oh, I will, no. With no other data, I don't believe that. Okay. I think also in the De Sitter case, I can use one finite dimensional Hilbert space, but you'll need a lot more than just that single Hilbert space to tell you what's going on.
Tom, if I focus on the algebras you're giving, and you take an infinite number of points, and this sort of getting an algebra where you associate each prime power on the number of times that prime occurs as that algebra grows. So so you could describe the algebra in terms of the sequence of primes and powers, including the nuclear power?
Well, the question that you're asking has to do with a part of this that I really don't yet understand how to construct. Namely, there has to be a set of rules. What I tried to motivate for you here is the following. Let me say it again, okay? This is hard because it's not a finished product that I'm showing you. What I'm trying to motivate for you is the following, that all of the data you would like to have about the geometry of the space-time is mappable into something that, using the holographic principle, we can record as data about a collection of operator algebras or Hilbert spaces. Okay. Now, the challenge is, how do I construct a set of rules for operator algebras which will guarantee for me that the net of algebras that I construct actually will produce, in the limit of very large dimensions, a net that corresponds to this Planck lattice in the space-time? I don't know those rules yet. And the questions you're asking are associated with what those rules will be.
If you think about reconstructing, you started with a bunch of numbers. You reconstruct the lattice. Is that the idea?
What you would reconstruct is the light cones. So I will give you
good points and defined points, and that would be the lattice.
Sure. You would ask for a Lorentzian geometry that has those light cones with those areas in it.
And whose apexes would be the total set of points.
Well, it's not the total set of points. It's the total set of points in this simplicial lattice, yes.
We didn't start the simplicial lattice.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the causal structure.
That's right. Which is something that I only expect to do, really, in some very large number limit for all of these things.
I mean, just think of it, that if I just give you a bunch of numbers, it's not going to work.
Absolutely not. I told you there are axioms missing here. The only axioms that I think I understand are the following. The one, you have to impose on the theory the following kinds of conditions. If I have a multiple overlap of three Hilbert spaces, there are many ways to get it as double overlaps of double overlaps, okay? And so there are a whole bunch of conditions that guarantee that if I give you the list of primary basic Hilbert spaces, the ones that correspond to complete backward light cones, I want to generate from that, or have associated with that, a list of multiply indexed light cones that correspond to the multiple k-fold intersection of k of the basic light cones, the intersection of the causal paths of k points. And you need a bunch of axioms, which you can write down, it's tedious, which will guarantee that this thing is well-defined and symmetric in the points and that there's only one Hilbert space associated with the k-fold.
Prime numbers?
No, not necessarily.
No?
The basic ones, the big triangles? No, they're highly composite. Now you're asking a very interesting question. I'll give it away. If you think about going all the way back to the past, this tells you what the state of the universe at the Big Bang is. It's a bunch of decoupled two-state systems.
Oh.
It follows inevitably from this formalism. But that's, when you go back far enough, things get smaller and smaller. They can't, the areas aren't allowed to get smaller than log 2. One, 4 times log 2.
Log 13, it's also prime, it cannot be factorized or any other prime like 101.
Yeah. Because the smallest entropy I can possibly have is 2.
I might have primordially started with a region with more entropy.
You want to just turn this one's pretty sort of infinite-dimensional analog of it. It'll work to just, for example, take Gaussian space and draw a space-like surface and take the light cones back and associate Hilbert spaces.
No, if I try to think about this in Minkowski space, then every light cone that I'm talking about here will have an infinite dimension associated with it. And the math problem gets much, much harder.
But if I want to think of realizing an axiom, then
I guess not necessarily finite, but I could have some infinite dimensional analogs. Why can't what I just said? So I just take in Gatsby space, just for the hell of it, just choose t equals 0, and I just start associating Hilbert spaces the way I might try to use to define quantum field theory on that space-like surface, and I associate those with the light construct. Do those? I'm just trying to understand your axioms. Do those realize your axioms or not?
I don't think so, because I don't know how to quantify the areas in those cases.
Okay, inclusions and relations.
I think you might be able to reconstruct Minkowski space instead of triangles if you look at those diamonds, because there you would have an infinite number of them that actually have finite maximal area. I mean, the triangles will always, the area will always diverge.
We're also
it's hard to get any control over.
Well, let's just counter to t equals 0.
The problem with diamonds is this question that we've talked about many times of determining which things are independent of which other things. So the key role that the Big Bang plays here is that it gives you this concept of particle horizon, and it tells you that there are certain things that are independent of others, and I don't see how to do that in Minkowski space. I expect Minkowski space to come out as a limiting situation.
You don't understand the spirit of my question. I'm not trying
perhaps
to model Minkowski space. I'm just trying to get something which looks like your axiom. So it seems to me, from everything you've told me, that if I take t greater than or equal to 0 Minkowski space, start drawing light comes back to t equals 0, and I start associating Hilbert spaces with regions at t equals 0. Mm-hmm.
But what areas are you going to, what dimensions are you going to assign to those Hilbert spaces?
Well, they're all going to be infinite dimensions.
And so then you have to tell me what are the, you know, the indices of the maps between Hilbert space 1 and Hilbert space 2, are those finite or infinite?
No, they're infinite, but you could do it. They're going to be inclusions of functions, spaces of functions on those things.
I'm not sure what I'm precisely gaining by doing that.
An example to show that your axioms are consistent.
Do you have one example of a finite, infinite space?
Sorry?
You have an example which works?
Of an infinite space? No, certainly not.
Not even, really?
No.
It's hard to construct.
No, we are in the process now of trying to construct what we think is the simplest. I'm not sure why, no, this, a space that eventually becomes infinite.
A space with an infinite number of points. I mean, that's what you're interested in, the simple one. Eventually, the whole space-time is an infinite number of points, a description.
Well, it's only got a finite region which has physics associated with it. It's got an infinite number of gauge copies of that region.
Okay, well, even within the horizon, you have a... Anyway, do you have that?
We believe that the simplest thing to look at is the P equals rho flat Robertson-Walker universe, and we're working on that.
But I guess the question is it it's not obvious that there is a solution for these axioms.
To these axioms, it's obvious that there's a solution. I can make you lots of... that's what convinced me that these axioms are certainly not enough. I can do lots of finite dimensional examples of just these inclusion axioms. They're just not enough to tell you what's going on.
Where the integer is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's no problem.
What is that?
Okay. An example, you start building it up in, quote, time slices. You start from two-dimensional things. Then at the next level, you build four-dimensional things by combining two of them. And then
As you're moving up, you're constructing your lattice.
Yeah. Right, and it's trivial to do things that satisfy these rules so far, and you get things that don't look at all like space-time. So these rules are not enough.
They're looking like some kind of tree.
They, for example, the thing we were looking for is in various space-times, you can look at, in homogeneous isotropic space-times, you can look at how the entropy increases with time as you go on. And these models just don't fit any of those rules.
So you don't know that there's anything that looks like reasonable space-time.
Well, except reasonable space-time. See, space-time fits these rules. If you replace...
Well, how about you start at the bottom?
Sorry?
You don't know that you get integers at the bottom.
Take a space-time with an enormously large dimension in Planck units, okay? And then you can always fit everything into integers at the bottom.
So, is there any problem that you get when you just start, take a particular example in space-time and just calculate the maximum area for every light coming back from some point on some lattice?
The only kind of problem you could possibly get into is that you're calculating areas, and at a certain point things may not be integers. But the question is in what units, okay? I mean, if the areas are big enough, you never have that problem. Okay. Yeah.
This may be a question for someone more mathematically inclined, but is this something like a sheaf? It looks like maybe a mathematician could answer that. It looks like you have a set of neighborhoods, and to each you associate an Abelian group to Hilbert space, and you have these consistent restriction maps. So is that...
But there are no neighborhoods. There's no space here. The space is defined.
Well, okay, you're
the space is defined by that collection of Abelian groups and the maps between
them. Along those lines, Thomas, there's something very similar to this. If you look at a space with a metric, there's a more basic kind of pre-object for the space with a metric, which is a space with a topology,
mm-hmm.
where you talk about all the closed sets at space, and then there's axioms for the closed sets, and these are satisfying the exact same axioms. Intersection to intersection gives you another closed set.
There are some serious problems that I have with the notion of topology. When you start, the way I think about this construction is it's some quantum analog of trying to build a set of charts for a Lorentzian manifold, an atlas of charts. Just 1 second, okay. So the way that starts in mathematics textbooks is somebody gives you a topological space which has the Hausdorff property. So it's got points, and the open sets separate the points. And I'm not sure what that could possibly mean in this kind of a setup, okay. I don't understand what the analog of the Hausdorff property is. In this, if I'm thinking of the space-time, the Hausdorff property for the manifold in terms of these backward light cones.
It kind of looks like you're starting with the shape and trying to reconstruct the space underneath it, basically.
Perhaps, yeah.
You've got to have the concept of open sets before you can talk about a sheet.
Can't you give the... Oh.
Yeah,
that's how the sheet's built.
Well, that's what these things are.
Well, no, I think Tom's right. The concept of open set looks very difficult.
There could be some discrete topology.
Yeah, but Tom is just going to do the Rorschach test, and everybody reflects
If we try to do a grid graph on your slide, we can just take two component Hilbert spaces at the bottom and just start tensoring them as we go up.
You don't get a structure that looks like that as far as this picture is a little confusing because this picture has two different things in it. It has every point and the backward light cone from that point, but it's also got all the intersections between those light cones, and they look like the same thing because it's 1+1 dimensional, they're really not.
You told us how to interpret the picture, and that's
If I make the kind of construction 2 by 2 by 2, you don't get a picture of inclusions that looks like this. Okay. This picture encodes in it, or the proper picture in higher dimensional space-time, encodes in it the dimension of space-time, and it just doesn't. Simple-minded algorithms don't reproduce that.
Why doesn't?
Can we just stop here? And this is so interesting. I think we should fortify ourselves with cookies and come back in 15 minutes.
Okay. I should also say that there's a soccer game which is supposed to be 30, but we'll just leave whenever this exciting talk is.
I have a question that
it's not specific enough during the approval.
How do you imagine, so, you know, we have bad ways of trying to help people.
You can take string theory and have some other W model, and there's some duty for all field theory. There are a lot of things that don't make sense.
Many years ago, I asked Ron Chris for some example.
I think holography also implies supersymmetry. And I think M theory is nothing but.
I think M theory is a unique theory that's supersymmetric.
I think it's worse than that. I think holography implies.
No, you just think it's unique theory that's holographic.
The intuition behind that is the twister transform. So what would you like to do in the holographic theory? You've got some object floating around in space-time, and you want to assign the information at some point on that object to a holographic screen someplace. Okay. Well, here's how you do it. You have to have a light-like vector pointing in the direction of the screen, and then you have to have the screen, which is some transverse plane to that. That's uniquely specified by specifying instead what's called a pure spinner in the language of Cartan, namely a spinner that satisfies the massless Dirac equation, n slash psi equals zero, for some n. Okay. That's something that in 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensions.
So n is a differential operator that you have
no,
to specify?
No, n is a light-like vector.
Oh, sorry, good, okay.
All right. So among all the spinners in just, you know, not spinner functions of space, just the spinner, spinners, just the spinner. Okay, you can ask the question, do they satisfy n slash psi equals zero for some light-like n?
Okay, good.
Answer. In 3 dimensions, they all do. In 4 dimensions, all Weyl spinners do. In 6 dimensions, all symplectic Majorana spinners do. And in 10 dimensions, all Majorana Weyl spinners do. But in general, this condition defines a nonlinear submanifold of the space of all spinners. Okay.
3, 4, 6, and 10 is what you said?
3, 4, 6, and 10 is the special case where there are also linear irreducible representations of the Lorentz group.
This is also where there are the strings.
This is exactly related to kappa symmetry.
Okay.
Where was I? Yeah, so the spinner defines now, in addition to completely specifying the light-like vector, because if it satisfies this equation for one light-like vector, it can't satisfy it for any other. And then you can show that from the components of the spinner, you can reproduce a like plane. Namely, if I look at psi bar gamma mu n for all possible values of n in your dimension, okay, these all satisfy p mu, n mu 1 on that equals 0, okay? So they construct for you a surface which is d minus 1 dimensional, okay, and is orthogonal to your light-like vector, okay.
I see.
So this is if you look at Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler, there's this thing about spinners where they talk about how a spinner is a flagpole plus a flag,
okay,
and that's precisely what this construction is. So I think that choosing a holographic screen on each point is like choosing a spinner. And that's almost supersymmetry, but not quite. There's some funny business I don't completely understand yet.
Okay.
No, which has to do with the spin statistics now. Because these are bosonic spinners. Okay.
How do these spinners come up together?
Sean, you'd ask a question. It would take too long to go. Now, the key Well, there's a formalism in which all of this has already appeared. It's called the super-embedding formalism for super-brains. Okay. And in the super-embedding formalism for super-brains, what you say is the brain world volume is a superspace, and the target space is a superspace. Okay. And the target space superspace coordinate, theta A of xi and eta on the bosonic fermionic world volume, has an expansion that has a term lambda of xi times eta, okay? And this guy always, in all of these brain equations, satisfies this twister equation. The twister equation is just this statement that a light-like vector annihilates a pure spinner, okay? This guy is gaugeable away, okay? Because if it weren't, you would have had a spin statistics problem, okay? And eventually you end up with an appropriate gauge, you end up just with the fermionic components of this guy. So that's probably why you need the super thing as well, okay? But the fact that you need spinners in space-time is holography, Eichling. It's precisely specifying for each point on the brain a holographic screen.
So you're saying the spinner naturally, you need supersymmetry to get rid of the contradictions to the distance. Right. So you say, in some sense, you're going to make holography
right. Yeah. Holography and consistency, because you know if you don't have spin statistics, you'll have negative norm states in the Hilbert space. It's okay.
So why can't we just take simple Hilbert spaces at the bottom line there and just start tensoring them together to get the same?
If you just do simple-minded tensoring of Hilbert spaces, that was the first thing we tried, we don't seem to get any of the relations between things. So you can now ask, So you can ask the following question. As you go up, you're going to get Hilbert spaces of larger and larger dimension, which you'll associate with the area. Now look at the dimensions of the overlaps as you go up, okay? And now you can go to some Robertson, you can do it in a way that's sort of manifestly homogeneous. So
but there's some numerical problem you're going to tell me, right?
It's a functional problem. In other words, that the way the overlap areas grow with respect to the total areas just doesn't fit the formula for any Robertson-Walker space-time. If that's what you mean by numerical,
yeah,
that's what
I mean. Yeah, I mean, if I literally just trace back and say for each one, I just tensor those Hilbert spaces.
Yeah.
That's going to be all these qualities.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why these are not enough. There's more, and we don't understand what the more is. We're trying, as I said, for our own peculiar reasons. We think P equals rho, Robertson-Walker spacetimes are the easiest ones. Okay. We're trying to generate an algorithm made out of discrete things that will generate the P equals rho, Robertson-Walker spacetime. But it's at the moment it crashed actually, so, but I have hopes that we may succeed in doing this. Yes, I know she did. We were hoping, my wife is going to be down here this weekend, and we sent her a letter and we're hoping to see her, so I hope that she'll be available and we'll be able to go see her. Great. No, we had. She's been, you know, we corresponded with her, so we knew that she was better, but I didn't know how much better. She tells me that she's better.
Yeah, well, I think that's enough.
It's wonderful.
What is that?
Move where?
I think the region.
We're living in, I'm working at Santa Cruz. I'm living in Big Sur.
Living in Big Sur. Corresponds to some series of
It's about an hour and a half to 2 hours to Santa Cruz, and I usually stay in town a day or two, so it's not terrible. It's typically Tuesdays and Thursdays for 2 hours. It fits in, and I can. Things worked out pretty well. That's the man. That's a good reference for operator algebra.
Well,
if it's large, the tree that is, you know, there should be a particular
that does everything carefully. It's caddis and ring.
If it's small, you know, there
should be. But that's seven volumes.
Two volumes.
Older than that, not just one category.
There are a couple of volumes of problems.
Oh, I see, right.
Two volumes, and it's carefully done so that it can plod through it.
What about something that's more like a physicist's overview?
If land is very good, we expect only it wouldn't be more all the coefficients.
That's on what you want.
Sure, yeah, of course.
So it's doing the foundation. If that relates to the
we know in the
what was the second one?
Is ring or
grows.
Ring grows. And that's what? I mean, is there some aspect of operator algebra you want?
That only end square.
When you say quadratic, you just mean
I just mean one of
but when we shrink to a smaller
unit,
how many reasons you expect that?
Well, usually they make the assumption that the transpose is in there, so that makes matter.
That's what these diagrams are trying to do, is that when you bring some of the matrix components, the expansion, the spirit expansion, just economically doesn't these solid terms. Can't be.
It's not out yet. No, no, but that's what I want to talk about for the rest of the time.
It's still in the supersymmetry, so there's nothing you can do.
I have those shoes. 26
Yes, they bought them. I bought them today.
All right.
That's bizarre that you believe this.
What?
It's not that I feel the wood. Yes. No, it should be no.
Yeah,
Okay, so what I'd like to do now is sort of, I want to very quickly just finish up this discussion of these attempts to build some sort of quantum system which will become, will give you things with the properties of geometry, just by making one final statement, and that is that from this point of view, it then becomes obvious that what one would mean in this context by a de Sitter space is the following statement. At any point, if you look at one of these light cones, HI, that one of these Hilbert spaces that corresponds to a particular light cone, that Hilbert space is supposed to represent all of the physics inside of the particle horizon, inside of that light cone. So what it would mean to have a de Sitter space is quite obviously that as I take I to infinity, as I go to later and later things that include more and more of the previous spaces, I end up asymptoting to a finite dimensional space. All right. And then one of the things that I keep emphasizing to myself and to everybody else lately is that all Hilbert spaces are the same. Once you give me the dimension, we have this thing in our mind that there's the Hilbert space of the harmonic oscillator and the Hilbert space of QCD and the Hilbert space of the nonlinear sigma model, but those are all actually the same Hilbert space. They're all separable infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. They look different because we've concentrated on special operators that are associated with particular Hamiltonians. But as Hilbert spaces, they're the same.
Physics isn't just a Hilbert space.
Exactly, okay.
What happens if you re-collapse or you have some other cosmology? Can't you get finite numbers in other instances?
I didn't say that finite numbers implied de Sitter space. Okay.
De Sitter space is an example.
De Sitter is an example. The difference between, re-collapse, as I said before, is something that I have lots of confusions about. But there is one clear difference. Namely, in de Sitter space, the evolution should go on forever. And you should just find that after a certain point, the dimension of the Hilbert space stops changing. Okay. Whereas the description of a recollapsing universe, at the very least, has to have the property that the evolution stops. And I really have problems with a recollapsing universe. And there are deep conceptual problems with even a de Sitter universe. And that's what I want to talk about for the rest of the time.
I agree completely with everything you said. I just want to point out that there is another example where you have the same problem as for a recollapsing universe, namely if you simply fall into a black hole in de Sitter space, for example. You don't need to necessarily look at a recollapsing universe to see that time ends for some.
For some observers, right. Good. Yeah.
At the end of the day, you have some... In the case of the Sitter space, you mentioned the true Hilbert space, and you're envisioning some conventional quantum mechanics acting on that Hilbert space?
Well, it's conventional except for the fact that it's got all of this extra structure on the space that's given to you by all of these sub-tensor factors of the Hilbert space that somehow constrain the dynamics. The hard dynamical problem, the thing that I haven't been able to solve, is the following. What are the conditions on this net of Hilbert spaces that guarantee that you can slice them up in such a way that giving me a pure state in each of the Hilbert spaces at time one enables me to uniquely define a pure state in each of the Hilbert spaces at time two? Okay. And that I think is a hard problem, and I think you need extra axioms in the system that guarantee that that's true. Okay.
What do you mean by a pure state if you only have a Hilbert space?
Sorry?
What do you mean by a pure state if you only have a Hilbert space?
What's the problem? I mean, a ray in the Hilbert space. Yeah, the choice of the ray. Sorry, it's just a vector.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So.
Sorry.
Yes.
This is what you just said, but I'm having a hard time understanding how time evolution fits into the picture at all. Do you have that time associated with each point?
No. No. The challenge is to have a collection of spaces with these inclusion relations, and what do you have to add in such a way that you will be able to slice it up and make unique mappings from one slice to the other that completely determine the state. Now, I believe, just 1 second, David. I believe that if you do that, that what we know about general relativity, and this is an extremely important point, suggests that you should be able to do it in many, many, many different ways. Okay.
So doing that in one way would mean you would have separate slices, and you would have somehow the same Hilbert space associated with each of the slices.
No, not necessarily. No.
Okay, so just some map.
No,
one Hilbert
just space. Map, some map from a collection of Hilbert spaces on each slice. See, there can be, one of the nice things about this formalism, maybe I should emphasize this, it allows for massive overcounting, okay? Because it allows for overlaps between the information in one Hilbert space and in another. And for example, it allows you to see how one might very easily in this formalism completely solve the black hole information problem. Because what you would say to, I mean, you'd have to derive this from the rules, but what you would try to say is that, okay, I am going to associate light cones with these guys inside, but there's a relation of inclusion in the Hilbert spaces that H1 is equal to H2 tensor D. Okay, that's something that tells me that one light cone is completely contained in the other, in the sense of information.
Which, what's H1 and H2?
H1 is a big light cone. The simplest example of this relation would be something like that. Here's H1, this is H2. Okay, but I claim that a proper interpretation of the Hilbert spaces in terms of spacetimes will also allow for the cases where in the picture H2 won't be contained as a proper subset of H1, but just the holographic screen of H2 will be contained inside of H1. And that I will then allow myself to say, yes, there's information that this guy can measure, but it's duplicated by information over here. His Hilbert space is embedded as a tensor factor in the bigger Hilbert space of the external guy. Okay.
Sorry, so, yeah. When you talk about slices, do you mean a collection of points or a collection of points plus intersections? I mean the latter.
Okay. So what would slicing mean? What I've given you is a collection of multi-indexed Hilbert spaces with all of these relations between them. What slicing just means is to double this index. In other words, break it up into a composite index, one of which I call T, okay, and the other of which you call some spatial index, if you will, something that's not a time index. And you have HT with, so, each of the things will be labeled by HT1, N1, TK, NK, okay? And now if I look at some set like this that has some maximal value of all of its TIs, okay, that has to be contained in some of the guys in H with one larger value of T. The time evolution will be discrete, because the Hilbert spaces have integer dimensions. You can't go to continuous time evolution as far as I can see. And there are consistency conditions on the time evolution that can constrain it to be consistent with all of these inclusion relations. Okay, but there's a further question of, you know, what are the real rules for evolving? And I really don't know what those are. I have not. Time has to be discrete because the dimensions are integers and you can't change integers in any.
It seems like this is a kind of rule to try to give. I mean, given the sort of structure you have, you can take H1 and say that there's some trace that gets you into H12. Right, and given that you're postulating that it's a system tensor positive, so that's the natural operation. And then physically, that's like, you know, think of the black hole example. You trace over what's going on inside the black hole, you talk about the rest of it. And so now you're tracing over the Big Bang and everything else that you don't.
No, I don't think that that's right. I think the concept of particle horizon means that the state in each one of these triangles, in ignorance of everything else outside, is pure. That means that the state has to be a tensor product state. It can't be a correlated state. Okay? It can only be correlated in some later set of triangles. Okay? So the state has to, in each, for each Hilbert space, the state always has to be pure. Okay? And that's a big constraint on the possible time evolutions. That's that. I mean, I haven't been able to get my brain around that problem. I have not been able to understand how it works.
Is it easy to list the axioms?
Well, I can list the axioms that I've got so far, which is far from everything, okay? You have a list of Hilbert spaces, HI, those are the basic ones. Then a list of Hilbert spaces, HIJ, which are related to the HI in the way that I said before. Then I have a list of the Hilbert spaces, HIJK, which are such that this is equal to HIJ comma K, which is equal to HI comma JK, and so on. All right? Where these things, each time I have a pair of labels separated by a comma, that means a pairwise intersection between these two Hilbert spaces in this tensor decomposition that I showed you. And then you have to insist that all of the mappings are such that all of these equalities are true. Okay? Such that H with any number of indices is uniquely defined by doing any partial, so if I have a triple overlap like this, okay, I can get to this one by first going to the overlap of these two guys and then looking at the overlap of it with the third one or any of the other possible ways that I could have done it. And I have to get the same Hilbert space in each of those constructions. The same, of course, up to a unitary mapping. There's, you know, everybody can choose his own basis.
Okay, I guess I don't see it. It looks like you just need it ordered, as if they're ordered along a line or something.
No?
You don't have to worry about... Is this all you have to worry about?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah.
In some ordered fashion.
Yeah, multiple intersections.
You're not grouping here I and K.
Yeah.
But if I have...
It's like thinking about sets in a topological space. There are multiple intersections.
What if I have... Yeah, but why can't I, in this last relationship, HIJK, can you draw the comma with IK pair first?
Yeah, sure. There are lots of other, I didn't write down all the possible ones.
Just with commas, you have to have some other symbol.
I'm not sure I know what you mean.
Well, I thought HIJK, would you first pair I and J and then K?
No. HIJK with no commas just is the unique result of doing it in any way that you like. Okay.
For three.
Okay. And then there's an analogous thing for four, which it
totally
has to.
Commuter.
Yes. Right. That's the basic axiom. Okay.
So this is the same as a set of axioms for inclusion of sets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's just, this is clearly not enough, as I told you, because I can make models that obey these axioms that just don't make any sense, to, as far as I can see, as space.
Those are the only models you can make so far.
So far.
But the simplest yes. way to realize this is to start with some points and just start tensoring up this sort of...
Absolutely right.
Like, and then in some vague sense, the new possibility is that you could start with points that aren't all different Hilbert spaces, but actually have some overlap.
Absolutely
you
right.
You look at that.
Yeah.
And so you could imagine the entropy being smaller at some stage than the naive
that's
combination.
Right.
That's what you're trying to accomplish in some
that's right.
interesting way.
So the way we were trying to work things out was in Robertson-Walker space-time, the P equals rho equation of state is the one for which the entropy increases fastest. And so it seemed like the fastest way to do it would be doing this tensor product thing with no overlaps. And then we looked at the relations for that, and it just didn't work. Okay. And it's obvious what's happening in the space-time. As you go later and later, there are more and more overlaps, and they get bigger and bigger. Okay. And this tensor product algorithm just doesn't allow you to do that. So we're working on trying to figure out an algorithm that does. Okay.
But to correct the thing I was saying before, I see that you don't want a trace, but it sounds like you want something even simpler. You just want a linear map that takes a state in H1 to a state in H1 2 for every vector in H1 to a vector in H1 2 for every conclusion one.
Well, that H1 2 is mapped into H1 by.
Well, yeah, if you posit something. Into
okay,
it,
but that's not the time. That's not the time evolution. Okay, that's just the thing that identifies inside of H2 which states were associated with H1 2. The time evolved thing. Okay, if I think of H1 as being at some later time than H2, there will be a vector in H1 that I think of as coming from the information in here plus a whole bunch of other things that came from the overlaps, which is not a tensor product anymore.
That's right. You don't have enough information to get it, but you do have, if you know H1, you may have enough information to get a vector in H2.
If I know a vector in H1.
Yeah, so that's the natural
that's
of the time evolution. And then
but it's flowing backwards.
Yeah, well, that's what you got. But then there are a lot of compatibilities between those.
Yeah, I think you have to...
Yeah, but then he wants to make sure you find the things in H1 that flow back to the tensor product.
Yeah.
Yes, but there... Okay, let me go on, because there are a couple of things that I find that this is, I agree with you, it's very interesting, and I apologize that it's not complete, and I can't really say too much more about it now, but there are a couple of conceptual problems with the entire set of concepts that we're dealing with here, which I'm...
By the way, Tom, before you go on. Presumably, I mean, as you were talking about this time evolution, it seemed to me that this is the first case of going outside of normal thinking that I've seen that where you could imagine more than one time.
You've put your finger on something very interesting. So let me talk about that. Okay. So for the rest of the time, I want to talk about two things that I think are related that have appeared in the literature before. And that's the so-called problem of time and black hole complementarity. Okay. Let me start with the problem of time. The basic technical problem is that general relativity and supergravity and all of these things are time reparametrization invariant, and you have one of these famous Wheeler-DeWitt constraints that say that the Hamiltonian or the Hamiltonian density equals zero. Okay. But that's not the real problem of time. Okay. The real problem of time has to do with trying to interpret the different solutions of this. So let me think about this equation in the simplest case that we know, namely the relativistic particle, where the equation looks like this. Okay. And then I want you to think about what's the Hilbert space here and what's the time evolution. And so the answer is the following. The Hilbert space is not the space of size of four x mu's. Okay. The Hilbert space is defined by solving this constraint equation and picking one of the x mu's, a time-like one, or a light-like one, as the time variable, okay, and then writing down a time evolution in that time variable, which reproduces this equation. Okay, this is a constraint equation that then gets realized in terms of a Hilbert space where I have psi of x and t or psi of x plus, x minus, and x perp, where the psi satisfy this equation, but they satisfy it as a consequence of a Hamilton or Heisenberg equation or Schrodinger equation on this state vector thought of as time evolution in one of the variables that's been picked out in a random way. Now, in this problem, we're very lucky, and we're very lucky in two ways. We're very lucky because this problem has nice symmetries, and it tells us sort of uniquely what variables to choose as the time variable. And furthermore, it actually has an ambiguity as to which variable to choose as the time variable. Namely, you could choose the time in any Lorentz frame, or in particular in an infinite momentum frame. And all of those give you equivalent quantizations of the theory. And one of the reasons that those give you equivalent quantizations of the theory is that the corresponding unitary operators in the Hilbert space commute with each other, the generators and therefore the unitary operators. But what's the situation in a space-time which is cosmological, and in particular a space-time which doesn't have an asymptotic boundary with an asymptotic, a nice behavior at the boundary, a space-time like De Sitter space, or even worse, a big crunch space-time. The situation there is that there's no good absolute choice of what time is. There are many possible choices of what time is. And furthermore, and this is something that is not usually emphasized in the relativity literature that discusses this problem, we're doing quantum mechanics. We're going to get a bunch of groups of unitary operators. By the way, there's no time-independent Hamiltonian ever. These things are always just unitary groups that, you know, have a, if you will, a time-dependent generator. But more than that, there's no reason for different choices of the time to commute with each other. So what we should expect a quantum theory of cosmology to have in it, as long as we don't have some boundary out at infinity where we can freeze everything and choose special coordinates and do special things because we assume the geometry has some nice form at infinity, what we should expect is that there are many different descriptions which are, quote, physically equivalent with each other, but they're also complementary in the sense of Bohr and Heisenberg. You can't simultaneously talk about physics as seen by one observer and physics as seen by another observer. Their time evolution operators don't commute with each other. One guy's time evolution operator will screw up the state vectors as seen by the other guys. You can't compare them. There's no way.
Of course, the same. There's only one universe. So it's
No.
Oh, you could imagine.
Okay, so here's an example of a problem that that idea can solve. Okay, and this was the message of a paper or a couple of papers that were written by Lenny Susskind and Lars Thorlacius and John Uglum. And it's also implicit in a lot of remarks of the Tufts, and neither I nor Lenny have been able to chase down a particular reference to this, but he says things like this all of the time. So we have this big problem of black hole information that where we think about what's going on as the following, that there's a black hole, that there are independent degrees of freedom associated with the observer inside the black hole. What does that mean? That means that he has a bunch of operators that commute with all of the operators out here. He has independent measurements that he can make. Okay? And then we say, that means that there's information in here, and we argue by causality that we can't have gotten that radiation out in the appropriate time that it takes us to see the Hawking radiation, and there's a paradox. And the, what the, what these papers did was, by thinking about thought experiments, they showed that there's absolutely no sensible experiment in which we have control over the physics, in which we can really think about low-energy field theory, in which one could ever compare the information as measured by this guy with that guy. The whole question of whether you can compare them has to do with experiments at super Planckian energies. Okay. Therefore, they said, it's perfectly consistent to assume that the Hilbert space in here is really the same Hilbert space as the Hilbert space over here, just acted upon by a different unitary operator. They didn't actually say those last couple of words, but that's how I would interpret what they're saying. There's a different unitary time evolution that describes what's happening to the states in this Hilbert space as seen by the infalling observer, and a different one is seen by the external observer, and that's kind of manifest in the classical physics that we do. The infalling observer uses a different coordinate system. There's a transformation, classically, between the two coordinate systems, and classically, you don't worry about whether the evolution commutes, because there is no such thing, classically. But quantum mechanically, there's no reason to assume that those time evolutions commute with each other, and if you assume that they don't, then you basically have legislated away, if you will, the black hole information paradox, or what you've done is shown that it depends on aspects of the theory that our naive space-time pictures don't really take into account. Now, the interesting and sad question that one can ask about this, well, is the following. And particularly today we can ask this, when there is quite a bit of evidence that has accumulated that from the point of view of the external observer, in fact, these kinds of processes are described by unitary time evolution, consistent with the principle of black hole complementarity. There's a question you can ask about, what about the physics described by the infalling observer? Does that have the same kind of objective meaning that the external observer's information has? And I think the answer to that is, it can't be true completely, okay? Because according to the classical picture of what's going on here, the infalling observer has a finite lifetime, all right? He doesn't live forever, only lives long in the limit that the black hole mass is very, very large, okay? And so there is no way that you can do, given that finite amount of time, there's no way that you can do all of the measurements that are necessary to completely describe the state of the system. Okay? It's just impossible. All right? Especially since the state of the system... This is before you hit the singularity. Before you hit the singularity, that's what's relevant for the infalling observer. He doesn't care about decay, right? He falls in a time of order M in four dimensions, and that's the end, okay? So, what I would claim is true about this situation is that there is an objective mathematical gauge-invariant meaning to the S matrix as measured by the external observer, but that for the infalling observer, there's only an asymptotic description. There's no exact description of his physics that makes any sense. There's only asymptotic description in the limit as the black hole mass goes to infinity. Okay. Now, I would ask you to compare that to the situation that I've just described to you for De Sitter, asymptotically De Sitter space-time.
Sorry, what does that statement mean?
Sorry?
What does that statement mean? There's only an asymptotic description?
Yeah.
Is
so
equivalent to the statement that for finite black holes, we can't discuss it at all?
Should we
still be able to discuss
for it? For finite black holes, you can discuss it if you're willing to live with an imprecision that goes like perhaps inverse powers of m or log m. But you can't discuss exact results for his physics. You can discuss them with a certain amount of play, All right? So there's no mathematically well-defined exact formula for what's going on.
Suppose I start with an observer that's falling in.
Right.
Are you telling me that I can't compute quantum mechanical probabilities for the results of measurements he or she might perform along his or her world line before the singularity is reached?
Yes. Not exactly. You can compute them, but not absolutely precisely. Because I'm not sure of what order the corrections are. They obviously go to zero when the lifetime of this observer becomes infinite, namely when the black hole mass goes to infinity. I think the corrections are inversely proportional to powers of the mass. But that... I think that the answer is defined only up to corrections of some order. All right? Or maybe it's defined as an asymptotic series in inverse powers of m, but not defined as a function of m for finding... That's right, which doesn't converge. Okay.
There's no unitary evolution, but so what is there?
Sorry?
There's no unitary evolution.
No, there's no... For the internal observer...
Why don't you go further and just say you can't do it? I mean, why do you need the asymptotic... Where do you get the asymptotic series from?
Because I believe that in the limit where the black hole mass... I mean, suppose I was talking that...
That's a very discontinuous change, right? Just like you argued with the Sitter's point. Again,
we could have
the same black hole right now. Yes. My expansion is 1 over lambda.
Right. Yes. I'm about to propose that.
Why don't you just say you can't do it?
But you need something
to predict the observations. There is a classical prediction which you know you believe because you know that it's possible we're inside of a black hole right now. Okay.
Maybe you want to see if there is some distortion of the density matrix, but maybe you can...
I think that there's really an issue. Let me get a little bit further. I think there's really an issue here of gauge invariance, okay? Because what was going on here was that we're comparing different observers in this system. Those are what we normally think of as gauge transformations, okay? The physics as seen by different observers is normally what we think of as gauge transformations. Okay. And the situation where we have complete mathematical control is precisely that situation where we say, out at infinity, there are no quantum fluctuations of anything, the metric is dead, asymptotically flat. The gauge transformations that act on infinity are not gauge transformations, they're physical changes of the state, physical state of the system. That's an announcement that we make in defining the mathematical problem and defines an S matrix situation. For the infalling observer, I don't think there's any corresponding completely and entirely gauge invariant physics, but only some kind of large M expansion, which is kind of gauge invariant up to corrections.
One second. So the black hole eventually is going to decay, so the space asymptotically is going to be flat and nice.
Right. Anyway. And so the external observer sees a unitary S matrix, completely gauge invariant, no problem. But the infalling observer isn't defined.
Different physics.
Yes. Different he has a non-commuting physics. Okay.
Which he does.
No, but he commutes with himself. He just doesn't commute with the
that's right.
observables outside.
That's right. That's right.
So
if
you don't want to ask about observables outside of black hole, why can't we?
Because his observables just don't, his unitary group doesn't continue forever. And so you can't imagine doing a complete measurement of the state of his system. Okay.
So if the whole universe, if the universe ends in a big crunch,
problem.
Nothing is well defined.
Yes. No, it's worse than that. I think in De Sitter space, nothing is precisely well defined. And let me go on.
Can you relate the problem to an operational problem in performing experiments from the point of view of the observer? What starts to?
I think so, right? That in order to measure all of the states in the Hilbert space, he would need an infinite amount of time. And the S-matrix observer has that.
Suppose he starts really early. I mean, we don't have any limitation going down.
Right.
And he has a lot of time.
Suppose we're not modest, we don't want to measure the whole Hilbert space. We just want to be able to predict the results of experiments that he performs along his world.
Well, you know, everything's correlated with everything else, right?
So, so of course, it's given by a density method.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure.
But we can't compute that density method.
That I'm not sure of. Let me go on, talk about the Sitter space, and I will. It may precisely have to do with that point.
Are you also suggesting in principle that we have a way without, of deciding whether we're inside a black hole by some limitation on what we observe in the laboratory?
I suppose in principle, but that limitation will be the limitation you know about, namely you're going to die in a finite amount of time.
No, it's more than that. It's some limitation before I die about what I can predict. Right?
Now, look, remember, when you said before I die, you're talking about a local measurement in space-time. That's a gauge-dependent statement. You picked a certain set of coordinates.
Right.
Okay? The things that are coordinate invariant are the things that have to do with what's going on at the boundary at infinity.
I don't understand. This is gauge invariant information. I can change, I know very well, that, the experiments that I did during my lifetime. So that's not gauge invariant state.
You don't know them with absolute precision, do you? You don't know the state of every single bit in the universe.
I think what's bothering people in the sense in which, if you define the problem as define the evolution of the whole universe with the observer as some system within this universe, coupled to his experiments, coupled to what's going on, then you formulate a problem involving the whole universe in one of your assumptions in asymptotically flat space. And there must be some answer for that, some probabilities. So if you phrase everything that way, there is a definite answer, but you're probably saying that that's sort of not universal. That's going to depend on...
Yes, that's precisely what I mean by that's precisely what I mean by saying that it's not gauge invariant.
It doesn't have the same logical status
as... Well, he's really saying
something like
I'm going, let me go on just a little bit more, and I will try to tell you that everything's really okay. So now I want to claim that the same problem arises when I think about De Sitter space. So what's the situation with De Sitter space? In De Sitter space, we're all like observers inside a black hole. Okay, there is stuff that goes outside the horizon. We cannot ever exactly measure what that stuff is, and for two reasons, okay? And I think there are two, and I think they're related, though I don't precisely understand the relation between them. First of all, I would claim that, although in not quite as violent a way, every observer in De Sitter space is eventually not an observer, okay? What does that mean? If you evolve in De Sitter space, one of various things happen, okay? Either you separate from everything else, or you're bound to some other things. Now, there are two ways in which you can be bound. You can be gravitationally bound to some other things, in which case you're in big trouble eventually because you're going to collapse into a black hole. You will quite literally be an observer inside a black hole, and your information will be radiated out into the ambient space and become part of the Hawking-De Sitter gas, which, by the way, we always have to remember, if we believe the formula for the entropy of De Sitter space, that has vastly more entropy than all of the matter that is in the universe by many orders of magnitude. The entropy is 10 to the 35 bigger, I think, or 10 to the, I always forget whether it's 10 to the 35 or 10 to the 70, but the number of states is staggeringly bigger than the total number of states that matter consists. Okay. The other thing you could do, you could run out to intergalactic cluster space, build yourself a little steel platform, and try to be an observer there, but then you run into the second law of thermodynamics. Okay, everything that you do will eventually radiate gravitons, and you just eventually you're going to die. Now, your lifetime is very long, okay? It's not something that we should all worry about, or we should live so long as they usually say.
So this is a precise statement, even I start things like hibernating and stopping all my activities for long periods of time. I can put myself in the refrigerator. And
yeah, but you still, you know, there's some amplitude for radiating gravitons every time anything accelerates.
But I suppose I can make it very small.
Yes, but not zero. So you can't live for...
We try this small.
No.
There's also the concern about the radiation coming from the zero.
In addition to that, there's probability, small but finite probability, for things to come in from the horizon and hit you and knock you apart.
Is that true that you can never lower your temperature below the temperature of the radiation coming from the horizon?
Not on sufficiently long time scales. I don't know whether this applies to...
That will correspond to you having wavelengths that are larger than the visitor radiant.
Right. So I claim that there is a problem from this point of view. There's also a problem just fundamentally thinking about a universe that has a finite number of states and measuring everything about that universe. Okay? Because the whole concept of measurement in physics consists of trying to separate your total system into pieces which approximately don't interact, and one of them can register what the other one is doing. And that obviously doesn't make sense when you're talking about all of the states. Now, okay, so I think, again, for De Sitter space, there's a problem of principle. There's no mathematically gauging variant concept of an S matrix. There's something that sort of corresponds to a situation where you imagine you go back to the Big Bang, you figure out what the physics is there, set some initial conditions, measure the S matrix on the cosmological horizon of De Sitter space. But there are many different cosmological horizons. Okay? And if you care about the existence of macroscopic observers who might be different, finite lifetime, but different from one horizon to the other, if that's the physics that interests you, then that's physics that's not gauge invariant, because the different horizon volumes are mapped into each other by De Sitter transformations, which are gauge transformations, and so it's not exactly gauge invariant. So, all right, I think that that's a serious problem, mathematically. I don't think it's really a serious problem physically, because I think that what we do when we make this mathematical statement about infinite asymptotic spacetimes is we do something that is somewhat arbitrary that we justify by the infinity. We artificially say we will consider only those situations where spacetime is asymptotically flat, everything at infinity is frozen, classical, there are unique definitions of what we mean by time evolution. Why do we say that? We say it because it's enormously big and it's got a lot of degrees of freedom and we let them all fluctuate. It's a big coherent object. Well, physical things, you know, people and planets and galaxies and so on inside a given space-time, even if they have a finite lifetime, even if they eventually collapse into black holes, eventually thermalize and are indistinguishable from the thermal De Sitter photons, there is some period for which they're coherent classical structures, and you can insist, I think, on restricting attention, at least with some degree of approximation, to just looking at gauge transformations which don't change those classical structures. Okay, it's sort of like when you talk to a lattice gauge theorist about telling you whether the lattice gauge theory is in its Higgs phase or in its Coulomb phase. Well, in principle, that's something that he can never tell you because that's only well defined for infinite volume. Nonetheless, there are very good traces if you're willing to neglect things that are of order exponential of the volume. There are very good traces in the finite system of the difference between the Higgs phase and the Coulomb phase. And I think a similar set of restrictions are going to have to be made in our definition of physics in De Sitter space to decide what we mean by gauge invariant physical objects. There certainly, I think, cannot be something that corresponds, is as mathematically well defined as the S matrix for asymptotically flat spacetimes, because by its very nature, if we agree that there will be different macroscopic systems in De Sitter space that go outside each other's horizon, for each of those systems, that system is a big macroscopic coherent object, and the other one is part of this mysterious Hawking gas on the horizon. I think the degree of precision or imprecision which is involved here is the degree of precision that would be involved if you insisted in your own horizon volume of measuring not just that the Hawking gas is in some particular thermal state, and here's where I'm connecting on to the question that Andy asked me. We know that the description of physics in De Sitter space from the low energy observer's point of view is a thermal state. And there's a question we always ask, well, what is the content of the states? Who are the states that make up that thermal ensemble? And I think it's only when you try to figure out what that state is with a high degree of accuracy that you really have to worry deeply about these problems of gauge invariance. Because some of those states are perhaps representing the degrees of freedom of the guys on the other side of the horizon.
But there's and a real difference between being prevented from doing that because you're lazy and because of the causal structure. It seems to me profoundly different, even though you say the net effect might be the same.
No, I think the idea of black hole complementarity, or of this more general De Sitter complementarity or cosmological complementarity principle, is that that's what causal structure really means. Causal structure doesn't mean that there are degrees of freedom over there that we have no contact with. Causal structure means that there's another description of the same degrees of freedom, which is not quantum mechanically consistent with ours, whose time evolution operator doesn't commute with our own. And that's how you resolve the paradox. You say, no, we have all the states of the guy behind the black hole. He's just looking at them in this other way.
Black hole, I can believe you. But you're saying the same is true in De Sitter space.
Absolutely.
Each observer has
his own. Each observer has his own? No. Each observer has the same Hilbert space.
Same Hilbert space, but they're not unitarily.
No, they are unitarily equivalent. They're the same dimension. Every two Hilbert spaces are the same.
But the time
evolution operators don't commute with each other. One of them, for each observer doesn't commute with, that's right. And that's the gauge invariance problem, if you will. It's you don't have an a priori way, mathematically, of deciding which of these things to look at. And they're only defined by these sort of things that happen over a finite span of time. And I think that means that they don't have an absolute, complete mathematical definition. But I also think that thinking about the physics, it's equivalent to say that as long as the system that you measure has entropy much, much less than the total in the system, both of those entropies being very, very large, and that you don't, therefore, say very much about what the state of the thermal gas in De Sitter space is, then I think that physics should be rather well defined, okay? That the corrections will be going to zero with the cosmological constant in a fairly dramatic way, and you'll be able to live with that situation, even though we won't have a precise mathematical formula for it.
There seems to be a big difference between the black hole complementarity situation and the De Sitter complementarity, in that in the black hole complementarity you would expect on grounds of unitarity all of the information will come out to an observer at infinity. While in De Sitter complementarity I can have a situation where observers are arbitrarily widely separated. So you know, think of a diagram, it's a very wide rectangle.
Mm-hmm.
So then I don't understand why you can necessarily have the conclusion that all of these observers are just gauge trans. I mean, why there's a unitary map between them.
They all have Hilbert spaces of the same dimension. There's always a unitary map between them. And if you can't, excuse me, Michael, if you can't compare them, if there's no physical meaning to comparing them, then I can always map them all into the same Hilbert space. Okay.
I'm sort of asking the same question. I thought there is a future space, like end of the Sitter space, and that according to your definition now, there are going to be, for every point up near there, some different Hilbert spaces. They have different...
No.
They can have some common P's.
No. The definition is that I maybe didn't say very clearly. In terms of these nested Hilbert spaces, the claim will be that asymptotically, every sequence of Hilbert spaces that are causally related to each other will converge to the same finite dimensional Hilbert space, and that there's a unitary map, therefore, between them all.
But the definitions don't require it, you think, nevertheless. So there is an H1, H2, H3, according to your definition, but they will turn out to be the same.
That's what the definition of De Sitter space is, I believe. Let me contrast that with another situation to make it clear. Take the same system, but imagine that what really happens is after 10 to the 55 E foldings, some scalar field falls out of a minimum or rolls down a potential, and eventually the space becomes asymptotically Robertson-Walker and has a standard causal structure with no infinity. That situation I'll have to describe with an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. And that observer, in principle, sees all of these different things as independent degrees of freedom and can make correlations between them and discuss whether they were whether they were different or the same. But if De Sitter space goes on forever, that's impossible. And therefore, by mathematics, you can map one into the other.
I'm just not sure what the physical meaning of that statement is then, because there seems to be a physical difference between the black evaporating black hole space-time and the De Sitter space-time, in the sense that you would expect to be able to sort of map back in time what someone inside the black hole sees,
exactly,
and then map it forward in the other direction to the guy outside. But there's I don't see a need to be able to do that for all pairs of observers in the De Sitter case.
But there is of course a mathematical possibility of doing it, so I can do it. And there's no physical measurement that you can talk about that contradicts that description of the physics.
I'm just wondering if there's something in your formalism that captures this difference.
Yes, the thing that captures this difference is that in the asymptotically flat case, there is a null infinity, there is a gauge invariant S matrix. That's what's different. There is a preferred observer, namely that one at infinity, that sees a unitary gauge invariant S matrix. And in the De Sitter's case, there isn't.
So in some, is it fair to say, I mean, the very naive thing to say about this S matrix of De Sitter space is that there was some Hilbert space at this past time, space-like surface, and there's some Hilbert space at this future space-like surface, and there's just some unitary transformation. You're saying that's wrong, and tell me if this is a reflection of your idea. The future really has these disconnected causal regions, and in fact some growing number of causally disconnected regions, and there is no a priori preferred one, so you should be able to take the whole state of the universe and understand it from the point of view of any one of them. And you may say, well, yes, that is how I ended up, but then a different region will get some different interpretation, and as you go on in late time, there'll just be this infinitely growing number of interpretations, and so no meaning to it at all.
Well, that's not intuitive at all. No, see, what really happens, I think, is that in most of those regions, there's nothing, okay? There's no physics to measure. It's all the Hawking de Sitter gas. There's no you, there's no galaxy, there's no...
But you might look for meaning in it. And what we're saying is that...
Not as I go off to infinity.
You just get closer, and it's a wonderful experimental situation, closer and closer to the vacuum.
Yeah.
So, very good to do.
Right, except it's not a vacuum, it's a thermostate. It's not a vacuum, it's a thermostate. You never know exactly what state you're in.
And if you had arbitrarily good energy resolution, you could detect a subtle deviation. It could never be precise.
All you need is one observer.
And so that's where you might look for all this information. And a priori, you know, there is this Hilbert space, there is a state in it. I say that means something. And
yeah, but what would be the difference between that state and the different state in somebody else's Hilbert space at some finite time? In the infinite time limit, I suspect they're just all the same. There's some physics that we don't yet know how to do, which is kind of the nice basis for understanding the entropy of de Sitter space. I mean, the basis in which we say, oh, here are the physical states of this system, and this is what their shape looks like in terms of some set of variables, okay? And I think what you'll find is that there's the thermal ensemble just has, you know, many, many states of this system in these variables, and there's no reason for those variables to be quantum mechanically consistent with the variables that describe coherent observers at finite times.
Yeah, well, you can make this argument that I'm not quite sure if we're talking about the same thing. I mean, it's a separate question of how, at some given finite time, that observer makes sense of this universe, and at very late times, how we make sense of that. And if we just talk about late times, then I agree that there's no observer and no experiment. But nevertheless, you know, somebody standing outside of the universe, or, you know, us writing down these equations.
But there is no such person.
There is, because we're just writing these equations down, and we can try to give meaning to them.
No, I think the equations that you write down.
You might try to say that because of everything you just said, there just is no Hilbert space at late time, because there is no meaning to it. But I think you're saying there is a Hilbert space at late time, so now one's tempted to give meaning to it. See, one way that would have been to say there was no Hilbert space, and you didn't say that. But I think there is this other thing you can say, which I said, which is that you know, there are just so many different inequivalent or complementary interpretations of this Hilbert space that you know, the very project of giving meaning to each one becomes meaningless.
Yeah, that I think is true. The only thing I think you could possibly define, which was gauge invariant, was something that kind of didn't care about the intermediate time existence of coherent structures and just said, okay, there's some basis in the infinite future, some basis in the past, and they map into each other.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the way you would do it.
And it would be gauge invariant. It would be exactly the same.
That would be a substitute for this S matrix. I mean, you could ask the question, if you stand outside the system, can I use it to make a quantum computer? You know, can I...
That's fine, but what I'm saying is that S matrix, if it exists, would indeed be gauge invariant, but it wouldn't tell you about the existence or non-existence in any particular horizon volume of a galaxy.
I'd like to make a suggestion that we continue this discussion informally.
Thank you.
Let's thank Tom.